experiences. But faith lives through time day by day as that reckoning with Christ as Lord. That is why Luther speaks of faith as an art that has to be practiced, or you lose it. This is a question for a while.
One of the common desires, at least I speak for myself, is the desire for success in whatever field of life. And there is a sort of prosperity gospel that addresses that. If you are a good Christian, then you should have a successful life. By extension, if your life isn't successful, you must not be a good Christian. But it doesn't attract me so much, but I do understand it. But there seems to be no kind of analog at all to that, or no answer to that from the Lutheran church. Is there? Am I missing something?
Well, Lutherans poo-poo the prosperity gospel, but we sometimes sort of have our own therapeutic prosperity gospel, you know, that the gospel will make you feel good about yourself and calm your guilt feelings and so forth. But, you know, I was this thing about success. My dad died in the spring, and he was 86 years old. And, of course, then you think about a person in ways you wish you had before they died. And my dad was very successful. He started out as he didn't go to college. He had a business college degree, which he did a two-year program in a year because he didn't have any money, and he persuaded them to let him do a year of the course and take all the courses. And he went from there to being the guy who ordered pencils at the phone company to being the CEO and, you know, president of the Virginia Independent Telephone Association and all of this. And I was thinking about my dad's life, and he had enormous success, but I'm convinced that the thing that drove my dad was not the desire to be a wheel. My dad made a lot of money, but they lived very simply. Because what drove him was the desire to do his work well, and by that, to benefit people. He was a demon on customer service. The only thing he was ever ugly to people about in the company was failures in customer service. And I think about that sometimes. And you know, the measure of whether you're doing your work well is sometimes success, though it didn't always. And I think about economic activity, you know, economic competition. Is this a good or a bad thing for Christians? Well, it's a knife's edge, you know. If you are concerned that your company or your business do its work well, which means serving customers, if you do your work well, you're likely to make money, and you're likely to put out of business people who aren't doing as well. This is the way that works. But and there is a difference between that desire for excellence and the desire to be a big noise, to see how many toys you can collect. I mean, but they're very easy to confuse with each other. I mean, it's very easy to confuse with each other. And that's the kind of thing that when the Christian tradition talked about mindfulness, self-examination, and so forth, it was talking about. My own wrestling with, you know, what does wanting to be an academic success mean? has been part of that too. So
I think it's a Denise, you go
no
first.
No well, Jim brought up like being in the subway and all the pressures that we deal with every day, and then you started saying that we see God through Jesus, the second Trinity, but the reality is God created us all in his image. And I try to be mindful of the fact that the guy who's pushing me in the subway and this one who's yelling at me that, wait a minute, you know, they're pushing me to lose my temper, but I just try to be mindful that we're all in God's left image up. And we all deserve calm and decency.
If
it had
been
respect.
Left up to me, it might have been different, but God loves them.
Yeah.
So,
so should I.
Exactly.
So should I.
Exactly.
They're pushing me, but okay, but so should I. And I try to back myself off and to remember that.
And the role of meditation on scripture in this is that it's the deeper the figure of Jesus who loved his enemies is written and lodged in our minds and imaginations and feelings, the more natural that will be. I mean, won't ever in this life be fully natural, but it will be the more natural. It's a matter of deep formation down at the springs of your way you react to things, that you get, by scriptural meditation, we try to let Jesus in deep. And that's, for me, the first question has been then how to, learning how you do that. And I read a lot of strange old books to figure it out. But yeah, I agree with you about the point.
Also, C.S. Lewis said, you've never met an ordinary person. The people you see on the street, the same battle, this daily reckoning with Christ is going on in every single person that you see. And he said, you've never met an ordinary person. Come the day of judgment, the people that bump into you on the subway, they're either going to be angels full of light that you would be tempted to fall down and worship if you saw them on the street, or they will be horrible demons writhing in agony in hell.
Or a horror that you meet only in your worst nightmares.
Yes.
Thank you, yes.
Thank you.
Exactly. You're good with these quotations. Better than the Yegos, obviously. So, thank you.
I was just going to say that I think the simple idea of getting new desires, that we are capable of cultivating new desires and turning away from some other desires, that's a liberating thought. Because when we have desires, we sit there kind of vibrating with a desire, casting around to figure out some way to satisfy it, and the notion that maybe we ought to consider whether this desire is worth having at all, and maybe we could just simply turn away from it, somehow acquire a new kind of desire. I think that's a liberating idea.
One of the there's a Latin work from the end of the patristic period, and of course I'm going to have trouble with the man's name, John Cashin, did a kind of tour of the great Eastern monasteries and visited with all the abbas, the monastic fathers of the East, and then came home and wrote it up, and it for Latin readers, and it became one of the spiritual classics of the Middle Ages that read it in every monastery. And famous point he made, Abba Moses, actually, who was an interesting figure, Moses the Black, he was an Ethiopian who had been a bandit and was converted to Christ and became one of the most respected of the 4th century monastic fathers, said that the human heart is like a mill, and it's always grinding. And you can't keep it from grinding, but you have some control over what you feed into it, mm-hmm. over what kind of, what you give it to grind. And that's the point about, and that was part of his, he was talking about keeping the heart, which is another word for this mindfulness thing. And it's also then why in this section of Cashin's work, there's a central chapter on meditating on the scriptures. That, it's kind of like the computer principle, you know, garbage in, garbage out. and of course, our world presents us with lots of garbage to put in. And that's another question we have to ask. What are our inputs, the inputs to our imagination and our reflection?
As you said earlier, right? It's do we really want that? I'd hate to give up some of the desires that I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Me too.
I mean, you probably
recognize them as toxic.
Well, but it's like, you know, they will not perfect me, just not yet.
There you go.
St. Augustine again.
Come Jesus, but not today.
The Desert Fathers, some of them, one of the helpful insights that I got from them was the notion that the seven deadly sins, which are in effect temptations, have a strong, they call them the seven deadly thoughts. Mm-hmm. There's a strong cognitive dimension where we presuppose that the world is a certain way, or that the only real options we have are in a certain range. That there really is no life after death, and so we have to just live this one. And once you start once that thought, which is a cognitive thought,
even though you may not be aware you're thinking it,
but your actual desires begin mm-hmm. to conform to that as the limit reality. And so I think one of the ways that faith, as one meditates and tries to in a more deeply way inhabit the truths of faith, that they actually reorder, those truths will over time reorder one's desires. But you also have to have external influence. I mean, we're social animals and we tend to desire what the group we're with desires. It's very much a strong factor, I think, in our psychology.
The way they analyzed this in the in some of the monastic literature in the Middle Ages is that we're desiring and we're rational at the same time. We're capable of reflection. And the traffic between reason and desire goes both ways. Because on the one hand, what we desire, just by desiring something, you're making the judgment that it's desirable. But then we get patterns of desiring, habits of desiring, that have these judgments embedded in them, and then they affect our conscious judgment, our reflection. So on the one hand, our minds can affect our desires, our reflection can affect our desires, but at the same time our desires influence our thinking. And so
so one of the points that I thought was very interesting and provocative, I never really thought this, is that one of the Desert Fathers says that our inability to control our hunger, mm-hmm. the fact that our desire for food can be omnipotent, is based in a fear of death, and a lack of confidence in the resurrection. which I thought, wait a minute. I've never thought that way. When I grab a candy bar from the whatever, I'm thinking about it. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, this is a kind of primitive human need we have. Food, this is our appetite, and so on. And so that what we do when we simply respond to our impulse, our desires, our impulses for food, is in some instances, we're saying, yes, the life of the body is omnipotent, and ultimately the life of the body is mortal. I mean, the life of the flesh is mortal, and because it will...
Which we'll go to great lengths to avoid facing. a truth that we will go to great lengths to avoid facing.
So that's your point about how mm-hmm. the interaction between what we... Because our desires are ordered in a hierarchy according to the way we think things work. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the regime? You figure out what the boss is like at work, right, Denise?
And I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yes. And then you reorder your priorities to fit in with what you think the regime it wants, if you want to succeed within the regime. And if we think that ultimately worldly success is the highest good, we're going to reorder our desires in order to succeed within that regime. And I think that in the Christian faith, one's convinced that faith in the Lordship of Christ, the problem is that we have other competing, we don't really fully believe that.
that's why the truth of Christianity needs to be communicated not only in kind of well-crafted abstract sentences, but it needs to be communicated in forms that can get into our, can draw our desires, can attract us. That's the preacher's job, in part, is to let the, what's John Paul is saying, called the splendor of the truth, the attractiveness of the truth, show through.
And this is a witness of people who live the Christian life with kind of an exemplary virtue. It not only is it attractive in itself, but it's also a counterexample mm-hmm. that refutes our secret conviction that's not right. we think nobody can really live that way. I can't really make these kinds of sacrifices. Mm-hmm. It's just too difficult. And then you meet people who do, and you realize, no, I'm just, this is, I'm talking myself out of it.
You're thinking in a box.
Making excuses. And it all goes back to what you started, that Paul talked about today. What happens on Judgment Day? Does the door just open, or do you have to stand there with your heart and Jesus knowing all that you've done, all that you didn't do, the small sins, the big sins, and then are you still going to get through the door? Will Jesus care about how much money you made? He'll care how you made it. But then it comes back to what happens on Judgment Day.
Tell my students, do you think that on Judgment, I tell my students for the ministry, do you think that on the Judgment Day God is going to ask you, how many programs did you implement? What was your budget? Or is he going to ask, did your people learn to pray to me? And that's a question I always... I'm not ordained. Many people address me as pastor on the way out today, but I'm a layperson, and I always say that my... They ask me, you know, why am I, what am I doing teaching people who are going to be pastors? I say that my credentials are those of the woman in the Gospels. I have suffered much at the hands of physicians. But that's what I want my pastor thinking about. So
then when I think about the Great Commission and the desire of a Christian's heart when you interact with people, perhaps of different faiths or of no particular faith, do you have any insight into what the desire of a Christian heart, especially living in such a cosmopolitan place like New York, when interacting with people who say, well, I have respect for yours, but don't try to tell me anything, any sort of insight into what the Bible says about how to go about living your faith, but also sharing it in a way?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think there's an easy answer to it, but, you know, on the one hand, middle-class Christians right now are very attracted to the supposed statement of St. Francis, which I don't really believe is authentic, preach the gospel at all times, use words if necessary. Because that lets us out of the embarrassing business of talking about Jesus. You know, I mean, we can just be nice. And that's our, we fulfill the Great Commission. I deeply doubt that St. Francis said that. I haven't had a chance to dig around on it. But of course, yeah, there are, on the one hand, there are people who won't listen if we give verbal testimony, who tell us no. And then there's also the issue if our lives contradict what we say, grossly at any rate, it's going to lack credibility. That's sort of obvious. But at least, hopefully, if it may be visible to people that at least if we're not succeeding, we're trying something extraordinary. You know, what we're up to is really odd and interesting. But I think, you know, ultimately it's not about us and our virtues, it's about Jesus. And so you do have to use words to bear witness. I live in a, you know, Christian ghetto. I teach at a theological seminary of the ELCA. I mean, I don't get out among unbelievers a lot. You all have more day-to-day experience with that than I do by far. I think that the attitude that we again need to cultivate is the sense that this is something really wonderful, you know, and our point is not to tell people they're wrong and we're right. The point is that this is it's good to know Jesus. And I don't know, you know, all the awkwardness and complexity, and I mean, if you persist in talking to somebody who's told you not to, that probably is not going to be the way to win their hearts. And I think everybody just has to negotiate that. But I think it's probably good to be aware that, you know, we really, I think, culturally are, and I live in the South where it's okay to talk about religion in public, but even so, it's very appealing to us to think that we can do it without actually having to bring up this Jew, you know, this Jesus guy, which is awkward and kind of doesn't fit into many conversations that actually, naturally.
Well, what if you're going through a dark night of the soul and the hope of the gospel really conflicts with your state of mind? Mm-hmm. Then you can't say that Jesus satisfies me or makes me mm-hmm. happy.
Well, I think the first thing is that, you know, I'm no stranger to depression.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think for me, it's important for me to be reminded and to try to remember that
yeah.
the way I feel is not legislative of what's real.
Yeah.
You know? And so I don't feel that way, but even the fact that I know it would make sense to feel differently, it would yeah. really make sense to feel differently than I do,
yeah.
is at least a start.
But if you're talking to an unbeliever, you can't justify Jesus through your own state of mind.
No, and that's pretty dangerous to do anyway. I mean,
yeah.
even if you're on a high,
yeah.
it's really much more than that.
Yeah.
And you know, I think maybe to be able to say why you persist, that you nevertheless, despite the depression or despite
yeah.
the dark night of the soul,
yeah.
you're hanging in there with Jesus,
yeah. Yeah.
and you found him to be worth that.
Yeah,
is what your personal testimony is going to have
yeah.
to be in those kind of times. And I mean, I tend to, you know. I don't always find faith easy, but I figure if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it in style. So,
yeah.
so when I don't think my personal, I don't myself think the way I feel about it is the most interesting thing.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't tend to share enough that way, but still, you know, the point is not how I feel about it. There's Jesus.
Yeah.
And I'm. The important thing here is not how I feel about it, but that I have found him to be worth sticking with.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And I mean, when one of the great things in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's discipleship, which is the proper German title that the New English title has, is he shows at the beginning that discipleship is really just about keeping company with this one, following this body around in the world. You know, just hanging out with Jesus because he's worth it.
Yeah.
Not because he represents something or because he is a symbol of something or because he can get you what you want. But Jesus himself is just, it's good to be there.
Yeah.
And and we all experience that in very different ways. And different ways on the same day, you know,
yeah.
and different ways in the same 15 minutes. But that sense, that awareness we have, which is a gift of God, that Jesus is worth it, is, which I, you know, I can never quite explain. I don't feel I can quite explain what hooks me to Jesus. I mean, my colleague in pastoral care is a country music fan, and he likes to quote this song, "There are days my head hurts, my feet stink, and I don't love Jesus." And, you know, that's how you feel sometimes. And I mean, his point is that that's, you know, the way you feel is just a fact. I mean, you can't, no point denying it or feeling like it's, but that's not, that's not what decides it, and faith decides it, and faith is this very ultimately inexplicable tie to Jesus that we thank God for. And
I just want to offer that on both of those sort of queries, that the two things is that finding the right way to say the good news through prayer, if we ask enough,
mm-hmm.
we won't be speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus will be speaking through us. And the second thing is that this doesn't come quickly, necessarily. we're, again, in the modern age, if we have a question and we Google it, we have an answer like mm-hmm. that. And this isn't Googleable.
Yeah, so, right.
So again, it leads us to think in terms of habits and you know, which again strengthen the faith.
And mainline churches don't do a very good job of instructing people in how to be public witnesses. I always say a mainline church is a church that divides the world into active and inactive members. A mainline church doesn't recognize that they're actually unbelievers, you know, but the world, everybody's really either an active or an inactive member. So we don't really think in terms of evangelization. We think in terms of, you know, I mean, every time I've ever been in a Lutheran church that was asking about mission, the first thing they ask is, well, what about these inactive members? Let's go get them. And I'm always a sense of doom because back I visited inactive members as field work when I was at Gettysburg, and I went to talk to Robert Jensen about it, and he said, well, basically, most of these people have actually made a choice, you know, and they might not want to admit it, but they've decided that this isn't important to them and they're not going to come back. And all of the statistics on this show that. I mean, it never works to start with the inactive members, but the that we actually are dealing, and you all live in a place where you have more experience of this, again, than somebody like me or somebody who works in Chicago in a church office. Even if they're in Chicago, their daily life is spent in a church office. That there, you know, we really do have people out there who don't want to hear it and don't believe it. And we don't know, and I don't think we're very good at, I mean, evangelicals try at least to teach people how to talk about that. I don't know how good Roman Catholics are at it, but at least they talk about doing it. They've sort of, John Paul II got them to face the issue to some extent. How far down that goes, I won't comment. But we've not really, and I think part of your situation is that the business of equipping us for discipleship, that's a neglected area. And I have to say, I'm not the person probably to supply that because I'm not in a situation where I deal with lots of unbelievers. Now, I have twice been asked by newspapers in the Carolinas to comment on the relationship of Jesus to intelligent life on other planets. But I don't see that as really the cutting edge of mission. I said basically, if they ask to be baptized, they're human, and Jesus died for all humans. So Saint Francis preached to the birds, but none of them asked to be baptized. So I mean, there you have it. But so
about the desires of the human heart, I bet that many of us are kind of rookies at getting the desires of the human heart under control. We're not sure masters of that.
I'm sure
not. We don't even have much thought about it. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a humble example. I don't drink alcohol. I don't drink wine. I don't drink beer. I don't drink whiskey. But I approve of all those things. I'm glad the world has them, and I'm glad they give pleasure to people. But I thought to myself, I've always thought since I was a child, I don't presently have this desire. So I'm going to try to never have it. Because if I introduce this desire, I have one more drag on my life. Okay? I want to be free of that. Same thing concerning hockey. I know I could come to love hockey. I know I could. I'm like that kind of a guy. I could come to love it. But I think to myself, why should I develop that desire? Why should I let it into my heart? Because then it's going to be one more pressure on me, one more drag. That's not a very sophisticated way of trying to get the desires of the heart under control. It's simply trying to keep out some desire that I don't presently have. What do I do with the desires I already have? Yeah. How do I get them?
I certainly have enough clutter already.
Have enough clutter. And how do I? And I think there's something to the matter of trying not to indulge. Don't indulge those desires that are at war with the spirit. Don't yield to them. Try to starve them.
And see, the thing is that it's never the case that the problem is that the created things we have desire for are bad. Because there aren't any bad created things. There are human creatures gone wrong, and angels gone wrong, but it's not bad to be human or bad to be an angel. There's nothing that has to be evil to be the kind of thing it is, because God created all the kinds of things there are. So, you know, if I love chocolate more than God, it's not because chocolate's bad. It's because my desire's out of order. It doesn't make sense, you know. And this is what St. Augustine discovered, is that the location of the evils in the turning of desire away from what makes sense. It may be a sort of Thomist way to put it, but anyway, so, you know, there are different ways to like chocolate or to like alcohol. So it's never simple. You've made one choice, and you recognize there are other ways to address that. So there's an element here of individual vocation. I mean, there's not necessarily one rule for everybody in dealing with these things. And we have to ask, how do these things figure in our lives? What are they? What function are they filling? What are they? What kind of time are they taking up? What are they getting in the way of? Or is it? You know, I mean, I don't drink often because I don't like drinking alone, and I live alone. But you know, I had a glass of wine with Carol last night, and it seemed to be in aid of good fellowship, and a good thing to me. Lutheran theologians in the 17th century actually talked about the psalm verse, "Wine that maketh glad the heart of man," and used to talk about das, I can't think of the German now, but the Christian bit of tipsiness. Because when it says, you know, God thanks God for making wine that maketh glad the heart of man, it's clearly thanking God for making wine something that gets us happy. And so Lutheran theologians thought there was, you know, moderation in letting the wine affect you, and basically in the atmosphere of conviviality, even though Lutheran theologians in the 17th century had a lot of concern about the drinking habits of Germans, as Luther himself did. But so there's that's why it's a matter of, you know, watchfulness, of awareness, of mindfulness about our lives. Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living, and I think the Bible thinks so too, but its form of that is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, where we ponder and reflect on our lives from the point of view of belief and awareness of the God of the Bible.
I thought to go back for me to the phrase, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Mm-hmm. And in the context, I think both in Deuteronomy, where it was originally, or for mm-hmm. that matter, when Jesus quoted it, and tempted in the wilderness, it was the idea that you take good things as God gives them to you. And God, and trust that God will give them to you. So, I mean, fasting can be, in that sense, whatever you said earlier about fear of death and unbelief in the resurrection or something like this. It's sort of...
He said that, but yeah.
What's that?
He said that, but yeah.
Okay, sorry. But if you give up control of satisfying your desires, trusting that God will give you what you need at the proper time, then you find freedom from, in some measure at least, from the misdirected desires and so forth.
Well, I think that, I mean, Lutherans have a long history of just not getting it about fasting. I mean, I think that's historically true. But, and I'm not, I don't have experiential wisdom to give you, but I think, yeah, that the people I trust tell me that one of the points of the experience of fasting is to sort of face the hold of desire in this very basic way on us. And it's not just about weight loss, you know. I mean, the sort of Lenten diet is not the point. The point is that we, in this very elementary way, confront the desires and the that have a hold on us. And of course, it's not wrong to eat, but the role that the desire to eat plays in our lives, mm-hmm. and that kind of spills over to thinking about other kinds of desire and the way that it the hold it has they have on us. So, mm-hmm. But
it looks like we're done for now. Let's thank.
Thank you. I didn't hear what he said, and I was folding my hands to thank the Lord. This has been a wonderful time and a wonderful conversation with it. You all are a group that has clearly thought about your faith in ways that I don't consider average, so in my experience. So it's been a pleasure to be with you.